You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. Once upon a time, we 4 hosts were traveling down a road when an elderly podcaster sped past us and drove off a cliff in dramatic fashion. As he laid there, before he kicked the bucket, he told us of a great treasure that would benefit the masses. We found that treasureful podcast under a giant W, and we have it here for you on this week's Zach on Film. As we talk, it's a mad world.
Hey there, Zach.
Hey, Steven.
Mad world.
Yeah, that is a couple. It takes forever to type out, by the way.
The producer-director, Stanley Kramer, actually wanted to go with 5 mads, and then he dropped it because he thought it was going to be redundant and make a lot of people upset because it was in there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And then he later would go on and say, I always regret not putting that 5th mad in there because it always is just that one more.
Right.
Is it 4? Is it 5? In there. So it's a mad world. 1963, as I said, Stanley Earl Kramer taking this on kind of after... Oh, what did he just do before this? It was some serious movie that he had done right before Mad World and
Ben-Hur.
Something like
Guess
that.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
No, that was after. But he was using this to kind of prove to people that, yeah, I'm not always doing just... Yes, that was the Nuremberg movie. People are always judging him on his seriousness.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, look, I can do comedy too. And he put this movie together and... turned it into quite a comedy.
Yeah, it was a hit.
Mixed results, but I mean, it made a lot of money.
Yeah.
In its initial release. Just as a point of reference, Zach, $350,000.
Yes.
In $63 would be the equivalent of $47 million today.
It's a pretty good box office.
So that's what. No. I'm saying the money that Jimmy Durante was telling him was buried at was the equivalent of today's $47 million. So
wow.
When you have
that's a lot of bills,
either 4 trucks or 5 people or, you know, 13 people or 14 shares or however you're going to divide that $350,000 is nothing to sneeze at. Now today you would say, oh, you're going to get $47,000. You're like, well, I make that in a year.
Well, I would.
And, Zach says, I'm going to make that in 3 years.
I would take that.
You make that in a year, you jerk.
But, oh no, I make much more than that.
Yeah, I know.
But I mean, this was a lot of money for these people to go after at that time. Mm-hmm. So that sets off this madcap race across the desert to get to San Rosito, which is in real life would be San Diego.
Right.
And the antics that follow along with it. Now, you must have loved this movie, Zach. You must have rolled on the floor laughing.
I did. And then the 20 minutes of the film passed, and the laughing decreased steadily. And at one point, it turned into bitter rage.
Why bitter rage? There's a whole intermission where you could get up and stretch your legs.
Yeah, I fast forward. I was like, wait, is this really happening? Let me fast forward. I thought it was just gonna be like a blank 5 seconds. Nope, 3 minutes later.
Well, there's music that's composed specifically for the intermission.
Yeah, I fast forward. Actually, I went back and watched the last 2 minutes of it.
I fast forwarded through the intermission too.
Yeah.
And the original cut was 3.5 hours
long. Yeah. And then they cut it down, and then they cut it down, and they cut it down again. In fact, there's still some scenes that are missing from the original movie.
Good.
good that they wanted to show.
Good.
Well, why? What,
so scenes that kind of make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you have a problem? I mean, it's a 2.5 hour movie.
2.5 hour.
I mean, there's
movie.
A lot of 2.5 hour movies that we sit and talk about.
Agreed. There's a
the
lot
Titanic's,
of Titanic's.
I think 2.5 hours.
There's a lot of 2.5 hour movies we talk about, but the same dialogue isn't there for the last hour and a half of the movie. It's just repeated over and over and again.
So what? Mama, I'm coming, Mama.
I'm coming to save you, Mama.
Okay, so we're gonna divide it up 16 ways. You get this. You get this. You get this. You get this. Cutscene to police. Okay, we're gonna divide it up 28 ways now. You get this. You get this. I get this. 3, 4, 5, 7.
But
seven.
That's funny.
It was the first time they divided the money.
It is. It's a long gag. So what, I mean, so was it just because,
guys.
So let me ask you this. Kramer used this as kind of his homage to comedy.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so in the process, he went out and got a crap ton of comedians.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people who, well, and again, this is, and I wonder if this is part of the ageism that often falls into film, where people who saw this would have known who every single person was. Mm-hmm. Right. I kind of know who everybody was in the movie because I grew up watching Phil Silver and Jonathan Winters and all these people that appeared in the movie. So it's like, oh,
Buddy,
yeah, Sid Caesar. Yeah, Buddy Hackett.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Mickey Rooney. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. All these people. I know who they
Jimmy
are. Even the little gag pieces, the Three Stooges appearing for the shortest cameo in the film.
Yeah.
Joe Besser, but anyway.
Well, Curly was dead by this.
Yeah, he was.
Actually, my girlfriend
Curly
pointed
passed
that
away
before
in
I
like
noticed
54.
It.
Oh, really? The Three Stooges? But I mean, even the little bit parts were people that I would recognize because that was still within, and I really think I owe this to Channel 5 out of Kansas City growing up, because they would do this afternoon movie all the time. That was their deal, is that you get, I think it started at 3 or 3:30.
Yep, and it'd run all day.
And it would run, and it would run until dinner time, which was 5:30 or 6. That's when the news came on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so they would run movies. So you might see Jerry. It would be a Martin and Lewis week, and you would see all the Jerry Lewis, Dean Martin movies. And so you knew who these people were. You'd see Phil Silver. You would see the best weeks were Planet of the Apes and Godzilla week. Those were the best weeks to watch.
When they'd play the three Planet of the Apes movies back to back.
Yeah. It was awesome.
And it wasn't the good ones. It was the last three.
Oh, they'd do all of them. 5 days, five movies. It was awesome. And so I knew who all these people were. You probably didn't even know. I don't know if you knew who Jimmy Durante was, if you knew who. I mean,
I knew Don Knotts was.
Stan, you know,
he was in a very small part of the movie.
Yeah.
No.
You know Stan Freberg.
Leo
voice.
Gorsi.
Maybe.
Andy Devine.
Oh, yeah.
Mickey Rooney. You know Mickey Rooney.
Why would he know Mickey Rooney?
He wouldn't.
I don't know who that is.
He wouldn't.
You don't know Mickey Rooney.
He's probably never seen
how
him.
Do you not know?
Rodrigo probably doesn't know who half the people in this movie
he's
are.
Mickey Rooney.
I probably know slightly less than half the people in this movie because I actually did watch old TV to a certain degree. So
it's
knew,
just called new television in Mexico.
Pretty much. I mean, the thing is, in Mexico, things don't go out of style as fast.
Mm-hmm.
So even though there is new TV coming in, people, like, they still air old movies.
Right. And that's what I loved about Channel 5, is we were watching all of this stuff.
Okay, I know who Mickey Rooney is.
Yeah. Alan Brady and the Maytag Repairman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I knew Milton Berle. I knew Sid Caesar.
Did you know Colonel Algernon Hawthorne?
Yeah, Terry.
He reminded
Terry
me
Thomas.
Of the dad
Terry
off of Thornberrys.
If you've seen Robin Hood, Terry Thomas does the snake.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah. And he also, I think, does the snake in Mary Poppins. Terry Thomas was a great character
actor.
Terry
Thomas was in The Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines,
yes,
which neither of them have seen either.
This was the first movie appearance of Jonathan Winters at this time.
Buddy Hackett had been around.
Jim Bacchus. I mean, you just look at the people that had speaking roles in this piece.
Selma from Night Court.
Yeah, is in there.
Is in this, back when she was just Selma.
Yeah.
But actually, she's the... Never mind. I don't want to get off on a tangent. If I start ranting,
well
be
so I'm wondering, is that part of it? Did you not get the, oh, there's that guy? I mean, because to me, that's part of the appeal.
Well,
is,
almost certainly
here comes,
not.
Here comes
I mean,
Jerry
if that's
Lewis,
literally the only way you can enjoy this movie, then no, obviously I did not get that.
I don't
that.
Think that is, but I think that's part of the appeal is how is he going to fit 100 great comedy actors into this movie?
I know.
Exactly.
make it an and hour Buster, too long.
Buster Keaton showing up.
Yeah, and Buster and Keaton's in there.
Uncle from My Three Sons.
Yeah, from My Three Sons is the captain. Yeah.
Uncle Charlie. Uncle Charlie. I mean, I think that a lot of the cultural references, especially in the last half of the movie.
Oh, yeah, last half of the movie.
The jokes are very topical, and it's kind of the 1954 equivalent of a Dane Cook routine. You know, when Dick Shawn pops up out of nowhere, you're like, ah!
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I know who that is.
So I can see that being, you know, one reason, not knowing who all these people are, trying to get them all in draws things out. I mean, the whole fight with Jonathan Winters and the two guys, the gas station attendants.
That was kind of funny.
I mean, that's
the whole place.
Yeah. I mean, that's a thing that lasts like 5 minutes or something to get through all of that. But to not go, oh, I know who that is. And Jerry Lewis driving over the hat. Ha ha. You know, all that stuff. So I can get it from that part. I guess the next question that I have in trying to analyze why you may not have appreciated this is, do you know what a screwball comedy is?
Yeah.
What is a screwball comedy?
Just a whole lot of nutsness happening.
Okay. Or you could also, farce is the same thing. Yeah, I mean, we could look at farce. What else can we classify in this movie? I mean, it's a comedy, but it's
slapstick
movie, and slapstick movies rely a lot on visual humor. And Sid Caesar is a very visual humor guy,
right?
And, with all of his faces.
Still, though, I mean, I would say that they probably, because there were so many people, they didn't nearly exploit Sid Caesar or Milton Berle or any of those guys.
No, not at all. I mean, Ethel Merman, I think, was probably the most exploited actress in the piece.
Phil Silvers, I think, was kind of...
He was overexploited, too.
Yeah, he was
for the big character that he was.
Well, and he was one of the huge names when this show came out, when this movie was released.
But, I mean, do you like slapstick comedy?
Yeah.
Because slapstick comedy, again, it's very physical and sometimes has a long setup. I mean, the whole thing with Sid Caesar and his wife trapped in the
hardware store.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is classic Tom and Jerry. I mean, you go back and watch classic Tom and Jerry routines. All the shtick that they do in there is, let's get out of this trap box. And you play it up and you play it up and you play it up and you play it up. And you just run it into the ground until the very last thing that you're doing is, let's use dynamite, right? I mean, they just keep building on the humor of, let's use a sledgehammer, let's use a blowtorch, let's use this, let's use this, let's use this, let's use fireworks, let's use dynamite. And it has to keep building. And that's, I don't know, whenever I look at slapstick, whenever I look at farcical humor, that's kind of what it is you have to keep building on that same joke again and again and again until you ruin it. Another good example would be like the car discussion that we had on our way to Nerdtacular a couple of weeks ago, or the boats where they were all stacked up on top of
one
another.
Right.
You may have been asleep when I pushed it to the, this is where this joke ends. But every time we would see another set of cars like that, we would take that joke and we would push it a little bit further. And I think that's what happens in a lot of movies, like what we see in Mad World, is that we keep pushing that joke until it gets to the point where you can't go anywhere else with it.
But even with that, you know, if repeated an overly long gag, as someone who loves the overly long gag, there comes a point where you get sick of it.
But it comes around again. Do you like?
And it comes back and it's funny again, because it's not funny, and then you kind of just lose your crap because it's so funny that it wasn't funny for a while, and now you can't figure out how it ever.
No, I agree. I think there's a lot of funniness when you push things too far, but I just don't think this movie executed it very well.
Give me some more reasons why. I mean, I would agree with you that it is a bit long, and I think if you would have taken out 45 minutes. If you could have taken out 45 minutes.
Well, the part of it was some of the good gags that could have been done really well, even in the length they were drug out too far by placing really not funny, unimportant gags in between their sequences of like even flying the plane, which is an incredibly long, if you put that together, it's like the last half of the movie is them trying to land a plane, good Lord, they would have crashed in the first 30 seconds. But you got that interstitched with the really crummy guy that picks the trucker guy up, and then he mm-hmm. like goes on this
side adventure.
This side adventure
own,
with this little
trying
boy.
To get out of
I was
this
like,
valley
this
and gets
doesn't
into a
matter.
River.
Doesn't matter at all. This isn't even funny.
Yeah.
So if you take out
okay,
some
so
of that
me,
stuff,
let me, okay, let me as deconstructing a joke.
Sure.
Right. What did Phil Silver do to Jonathan Winters? Got him to tell the story of of where this money was hidden.
Uh-huh.
And then it's like, okay, yeah, we'll go down to Santa Rosita together and we'll dig up this money and we'll get it before everyone else. We'll split it 50-50. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Hey, kid, move that bike so nobody trips over right. it in the dark. Jonathan Winters gets out. Phil Silver, off right. he goes. What do we know about karma?
Comes back to get you.
So doesn't it come back to get Phil Silver in the fact that he's trying to, he's okay, I'll help you get the, you know, he's not a total shit, right? He's willing to help the farmer get the medicine to his wife.
Sure.
But karma has to swing back around and say, okay, if you're going to get back on this adventure, you've got to go through hell to get back into this adventure.
But in the end of the movie, everyone gets nothing. So almost the karma almost doesn't come into it at all. Because
no, it does. It does come into it at the end. Where
but
they
everyone leaves
and
out
everybody's
on a,
going
on
everybody
even.
Is broken, everybody is hobbled, and yet even among their downfall, they're still able to laugh at the insanity of everything that's gone on to them. They're able to still laugh at themselves about it. You know, on the one hand, you can look at this movie as a comedy, as a farce, as whatever, but Kramer, with a lot of the other movies that he's done, you know, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which came out after this movie, looking at race relations. You look at the Nuremberg trial, very serious look in there. And really the seriousness of this, one can almost say that he's holding up in this movie a mirror to society and looking at a lot of very uncomfortable situations and making us laugh about how uncomfortable these topics are. I mean, here are people that this entire movie, they are consumed by nothing but greed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, greed. I mean, that mm-hmm, is the core mm-hmm. of what this movie is about, is how greedy can you be? And what would you do to get all this money for yourself? And we see a good cop turn bad at the end because of greed.
Mm-hmm.
And there are crooked cops. We see a man who is broken down and who is just browbeaten by his mother-in-law nonstop. We see socioeconomic relations between the dentist and the truck driver
mm-hmm.
and how Jonathan Winter's character and Sid Caesar's character are butting heads with one another because they don't agree because of their financial situations. I think even the Mickey Rooney and Buddy Hackett also get into it with the dentist when they're trying to get the airplane because they come from different economic mm-hmm. statuses. And then we see some politics come into it when they're talking about how, oh, you get $47,000 tax free.
Yeah.
What do you mean tax free? What do you mean you wouldn't report this to the government? That's our duty to, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, there is a political belief right there that yes, you do have to report all this money. So it is holding a mirror up to society and saying, look how ugly we are in everything that's going on in this time period. And can't we laugh at it? Can't we laugh at how ridiculous we are as a society? I mean, we do that now, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we look at Honey Boo Boo and we're like, this is what we've come to. Right. And people laugh about it.
That Honey Boo Boo is playing it straight.
Well, yeah. Yeah. But I mean, isn't that the case though? I mean, sure. we look at, I don't know, just look at anything. People are making a joke about something that's very serious going mm-hmm. on right now in our society, and we're able to find humor in that. And I think that's what Kramer is trying to do. Now, granted, he didn't write this story. This was a story that came to him from a story that was supposed to take place in Scotland. The guy who wrote it brought it to him. And he said, yes, I want to do this. And so they changed the location to Southern California
mm-hmm.
and then
mm-hmm.
moved everything to the United States in that. But I think I think this is a good reflection on society and the things that were going on at the time period and things that were reflected in people's minds at this time of
yeah.
what was acceptable, what wasn't acceptable. What can we really make fun of, even if it's our own stupidity? What were you going to say, Matthew? Sorry.
Oh, I would agree with you. And I think that if you tried to sell a movie today where the climactic joke was Ethel Merman slipping on a banana peel, And that's our big out. Dun, 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 dun.
Well, and also
I don't think that would fly. I don't think that would fly in the '70s, but I don't think that would certainly fly in the 21st century.
So, Matthew, in the evolution of comedy, what's going on? What's going on in society in the early '60s? I mean, we're still a very uptight society, right? I mean, we haven't experienced the hippie revolution. We're not into Vietnam yet. When did Lenny Bruce was in the '50s.
Lenny Bruce would have been around. You would have seen the beginnings of, some of the comedy stuff that led to the likes of, George Carlin and, what's his face with the head, Captain Jack,
the Smothers Brothers.
Yeah. That guy, those guys too would be in 67, 68. Mm-hmm. I mean, the counterculture revolution has its roots. But if you look at this, this is a lot of guys who were big on television in the '50s.
Mm-hmm, good, clean cut television.
Mm-hmm.
But this movie isn't necessarily that. This movie is kind of like the last hurrah for guys like Milton Berle and guys like Sid Caesar and Sergeant Bilko, whose name always escapes me. Sid Caesar and Phil Silvers.
Right.
Sort of merge into this one C. Silvers in my head.
Oh, man, I was watching this movie going dead.
The ooh-ooh guy is in it for like five seconds. Yeah, I don't remember his name, but I remember he was a guy doing his voice was the sergeant on Hong Kong Phooey.
Mm-hmm.
All of these, you know, not all of these, but the majority of these actors are guys from the 50s and earlier. Your Buster Keatons, your Three Stooges. These are people trying to take that last hurrah for – and I think to some degree for their world, but at least the world view of the comedy that they're used to and trying to turn it into that new expectation. And I think that from the point of view of what actually happens on the film, they succeed about 55% of the time.
Yeah, you know, when
there's
when
a moment where it's clearly Rochester.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hey, it's that guy.
And Jack Benny, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, the screwball, the scholars will say that the last screwball comedy came out in 1942. That was when the last real screwball comedy comes out. And so when you're looking at this, you're right. This is pointing towards audiences saying, hey, remember how comedy used to be. This was that last hurrah before you came up to, hey, MFers, what's going on? Kind of comedy stuff. Yeah.
You get to that point where George Carlin is joking about ICBMs and weed.
Yeah.
But if you look at some of these guys, some of these actors did transition. Don Knotts.
Oh, Buddy Hackett did too.
Transitioned into the '70s. Yeah. Buddy Hackett. A lot of these characters got into, you know, the next decade and even the decade further than that. I know that Mr. Roper is in here.
Yes.
Mr. Roper from the late 1970s. You'll remember him. And Sterling Holloway, the voice of Winnie the Pooh.
Mm-hmm. As the county sheriff.
Nice.
Yeah, when you look at it as a whole, this to me is kind of like not just a last hurrah. It's like kind of a transition. It's that moment where The Rock loses clean to John Cena, kind of to pass the torch, but also kind of to say, well, maybe there is some, you know, some justification in what's going on here. So all of these guys are here, and this is also trying to be part of this new wave of comedy that's going places where we didn't see it, you know, that's going off into its other world. And we can still be a part of that, and we can, you know, we can validate and justify the 1950s, your Milton Berle in a dress. But then you can also transition into that point where, you know, the Smothers Brothers are joking about the Vietnam War. And you can actually get your Pat Paulson routine. That comes straight out of this. When Pat Paulson is sitting and making jokes about the world, that comes out of this style, this thought process of comedy. But it allows it to deal with different sorts of, you know, more realistic themes and to deal with things that are important to people to make it funny while still being about something important.
This movie was so big in what was happening when they were getting ready for production, that there were comedians that they approached who, or actors and actresses who they approached who just simply couldn't do it because their schedule wouldn't permit. I mean, originally the Sid Caesar and his wife characters were going to be played by Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. They were going to be a husband-wife team. Wow. But she couldn't do it because she was in production of a TV series, so Mickey Rooney still wanted to be part of it. So they switched him around. They brought in, what's his name, Carl, was it Novak, Kovac, Ernie Kovac.
Ernie Kovac.
Ernie Kovac was supposed to play the Sid Caesar role with his real-life wife. That was his real-life wife in there. Mm. But he died. Oh. And so then Sid
Ernie
Caesar
Kovac
was born.
Died in like 62.
Yeah, so then the wife... what's her name?
Edie.
Edie Adams. She agreed to go ahead and be in the movie, and then they brought Sid Caesar in. And so they were doing a lot of this play around, and it got to the point where there were some actors and actresses that were calling up Kramer going, how come you didn't ask me to be in your movie? Mm-hmm. And it's just like, we don't have any play. We don't have any room for you to be in this.
There are already 37 characters in this movie.
I mean, just the credits alone are, what, six minutes long?
Oh, so long.
Saul Bass.
Yeah. Every single person in this movie
they're good credits.
Is somebody. You look at this and you're like, oh, hey, it's that guy who used to hang out with Tom Mix. There's not a single character in this movie who's not a hey, it's that guy to the right person.
Right. So,
and even, you know, even like knowing what I know,
Austin
I don't
Powers
get all.
2 situation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. You know, when we talk about could this movie be made today? Yeah, they actually tried to make this movie today. It's called Rat Race, and it failed horribly. But it was basically the same story.
Which was fun to watch to see what.
Did you watch it?
I've seen Rat Race. Oh, I saw Rat Race.
Did you
a
like
long
it?
Time ago. Oh,
Seth
well, I was
Green
like, I was
is
like
no
12.
Phil
of course
Silver.
I liked
okay,
it. I was 12.
Okay, so next question then, Zach. Have you watched, has anyone else in your family seen this Mad World?
Yeah.
Who?
My dad and my 8-year-old brother.
And you said you had a conversation with your dad about this.
Yes. He thinks this movie is hilarious, and apparently so did my 8-year-old brother.
You thought Rat Race was funny when you were 12.
Yeah.
This has that kind of humor that appeals to young kids. I remember watching, I didn't realize that this movie was in color until probably like 85, something like that, when I caught it at my grandparents' house, because growing up, I had black and white television. When this came on, I was either watching it on when I was really young, the big black and white in the living room, or when we did get color TV and then dad would want to watch sports, I was relegated to a little 13-inch black and white upstairs. Mm-hmm. And so all I knew was this movie in black and white. And this, because of my age at that time, I thought this stuff was hysterical. I thought the whole shenanigans about chasing with the money and the busting stuff up and stuff, I love that stuff as a kid. In fact, when I would do Legos and Star Wars, I would take this idea of these things keep building and more things keep getting destroyed. And that was my routine when playing with toys was, how can I make this bigger and build better? And all these things are happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it all blows up on everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fun for me. So from a little kid's perspective, I can see it. But I think our humor changes over time.
Our humor is... I thought about this a lot because... Obviously, when I'm assigned a movie on this podcast, I'm assuming it's of high standards and is significant in some way. So I was reflecting.
Well, I mean, this does have, you know.
Let
the man finish.
I was reflecting on why this is important.
Why this is on the show.
But then I was also reflecting on why didn't I like this when I probably, obviously, this was a well-received movie and was very important for its time. I was like, out of all the old movies, old being a relative to my age term, that I will watch.
Like 1999 and prior.
Right, correct.
He's probably never seen a Richard Pryor movie.
Maybe I'd go through the list.
He saw Harlem Nights.
No.
There's no way he saw Harlem Nights.
Not a chance.
No, he saw
Comedies, I feel like, would be the hardest to transition to today's because it's changed so much that they're just not going to translate.
Do you like the Three Stooges?
I mean, I've never really watched them, but
I thought my son would just roll on the floor watching Three Stooges.
Mm-hmm.
And we were watching one of their 20-minute shorts. And about 5 minutes in, he's like, can we watch something else? This is boring. I'm like, this is the Three Stooges. This is funny. And I don't find this funny at all.
I watched a few episodes. I thought they were funny. But the thing is, Three Stooges has going for it in the slapstick nature. It's like 20-minute episodes. It's not a 2.5-hour movie.
Right.
You can compress
I
in the slapstick. It's like super funny, but you get drawn out.
Right. I totally agree with you on the fact that it is long. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, it is a long movie, and I will agree with you on that. But where you start cutting and not get that build of the laughter, I don't know where you can cut. Do you know, Rodrigo?
Yes, I do.
I would have cut out the...
There's a couple of times that we keep cutting back to a very similar situation. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the son, like, driving, Mama, yeah. Mama, I'm coming to save you. That happens, like, four times.
Yeah.
It's like, cut two of those out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, car chase. Who is that guy? I think he's that guy. Cut that out.
Yeah.
So one of the cool things about this, though, when we keep cutting back to Mama, what's his name? Dave, what was his name, Matthew?
Dick Shawn.
That's who that
Dick
was.
Dick Shawn, yeah.
One of the cool things about this movie from a storytelling perspective, Zach, is this concept of parallel storytelling, right?
Yeah.
A lot of times you'll look at a movie like, what was the Philip Seymour Hoffman movie that came out not too long ago?
The Master.
Tells a story that's very straightforward from one thing to another, and it just flows all the way through, and you're seeing it from the one character's perspective. Spring Breakers, that we were talking about earlier, same way. We're really seeing this through one kind of character's perspective. We don't see what's going on other places. In parallel storytelling, you're seeing what's going on simultaneously in other places,
right?
And so what Mad World does really well is make sure that you know that while Sid Caesar is trying to bust out of the hardware store, Buddy Hackett and Mickey Rooney are still up in the air having their antics in the air. And we keep cutting back and forth between all these things that are happening simultaneously. And so parallel storytelling is a great way to move people through your story.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are not a lot of movies done today that do parallel storytelling like this movie does. I mean, occasionally you'll do a cutaway of what's the villain doing now. He's twisting his mustache.
Right.
He's getting ready to blow up the Death Star, but we're mostly focused on Luke Skywalker, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're not really seeing a lot of what Han Solo is doing on the Death Star while Luke is out running around.
Yeah.
Really, the closest thing that we see nowadays is either more indie films that do kind of just different characters, or we just see the movie like expand and compress, like kind of like an Ocean's 11. Now everybody goes and does their thing. Right, so you're kind of cutting back and forward as everybody's going. Right. And then eventually the movie just like funnels back into everybody being together.
Everybody together.
So parallel storytelling is a great technique to make sure your audience is knowing what's going on with multiple characters at the same time.
It is a tough technique.
It is.
It is a master level technique.
I like the concept of this movie because I think there's a lot of funny, and I honestly was laughing extremely hard in the first,
20 minutes.
Take out the credits.
You're right.
Like 20 minutes.
The minute that Jimmy Durante kicks the bucket.
It's literally the funniest part of the movie.
It is so funny.
It's the best thing. I just lost it. Like that, okay, this movie has to be amazing. And it went downhill a little after. I thought there was a lot of good parts after they find out about the money and they're trying to figure out. His truck is like walking around the corner.
I actually thought that Phil Silvers really adds an edge to the movie.
Oh,
like, there's that character and everybody's like, okay, yeah, let's be nice. It's like, no, let's all go for it. Mm-hmm. But the minute that guy walks in, it's like, this guy is a bastard. He is like the biggest rat bastard in this movie. And from the moment you meet him until the end, he is trying to cheat everyone.
When we look at it, this would be a perfect movie. A few weeks ago, Matthew over at our website, majorspoilers.com, had a question of the day about the 9 grid system where you go from, you know, was it positive good to
lawful good to chaotic evil?
Yep.
You can plug all these characters into one of these holes, and Phil Silvers would be chaotic evil all the way. Although Jerry Lewis would be almost borderline chaotic evil in his
world. How long is he in there?
But I mean, if you're taking all the characters that appear, he would definitely be in that.
There's 86 characters in this movie, though, so there's only 9 spaces.
But I don't.
Oh, but it's an 86-point font because this guy is neutral, chaotic, stupid.
But, I mean, you could find people that fit into every category. I don't know if you would... Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, even the cops fit into the lawful good category.
Well, I mean...
Except for Spencer Tracy, who's
up until he falls into lawful neutral, yeah.
Emmeline, like the...
Yeah. Sid Caesar's wife?
No, the other one.
Oh, right.
Milton Berle's wife.
Milton Berle's wife, yeah. who wants to sit in the car.
Right, right.
But she's that way until she sees the W and she's like, oh, I've got it. I've got it. Let's go dig it up. And
right.
she believes it finally. So, but I mean, yeah, you could really fit people into that 9-point grid and it would tell you a lot about, you know, how they develop these characters.
Yeah.
Why don't we do a quick shout out to some of the people that, that made this episode possible.
People, we like to thank our listeners for helping us continue pulling up Google Drive. Oh, there they are. Shout outs. Here we go. You people help make this show possible. Peter Fasson, Jason Foreman, Daniel Coter, John Morales, Brian Feniff, Melanie Nazora, Joshua Matthew.
I think that's pronounced Matthew.
Nope. I think you tell me that different every time. Ross Mandin, Michelle Rentner.
Guillaume Belrube,
and Trace Taylor.
I apologize
for that last one. Thank you, all of you wonderful donors, each and every one of you, to keep this.
I think it's actually pronounced Malani.
I'm going to say educational programming on the air.
Well, yeah, it is.
Look at that.
I hope it is. I mean, some people say they've learned a lot.
Yeah.
From the show. Other people have additional commentary. We were talking a couple of episodes ago about scripts.
Yeah.
Bruce Otter pointed me to a great article about how we got into this situational script writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Save the Cat is the Book. I actually bought it today. You might want to check it out.
Okay.
It talks about how we got into the current script story structure that we're at now.
It's Save the Cat?
Save the Cat.
Okay.
Because obviously that's what you're trying to do in the movie. Save the Cat.
Save the Cat, ride a cowboy. something like that. I don't know. My wife has it on a shirt. I presume it makes sense in context.
Not in this context, but okay. Anyway.
Awesome.
But a lot of people are getting something out of this, and we hope that you, listener, are getting something out of this, and certainly we want to thank you who have contributed and become VIP members, recurring donors, whatever you want to call yourselves. We thank you for that kind of support.
Hey, Zach. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Matthew?
You know that moment in the show when I tell you something that has nothing to do with the movie that's fascinating anyway?
Yep.
You know Dick Shawn, the son, Sylvester?
Mama, yeah. I'm coming for you, Mama.
Do you know why I remember Dick Shawn?
Because you really liked doing the twist?
No, I hated the twist. Dick Shawn is actually memorable for the way he passed away. He was on stage doing stand-up and was making jokes. And he was talking about, you know, how he was pretending to be a political campaign guy. And he's like, if elected, I will not lay down on the job. Then he passed out, collapsed, and died on stage.
That...
And everyone thought it was part of the act. No, it's not funny.
Well, I mean, no, I mean, in context, it's kind of funny.
But contextually, everyone thought it was part of the
joke. See, that's what dark humor is, and that's why everybody hates my humor, because it's often very dark like that.
And they came out and they gave him CPR, and they said, everybody go home, and everybody thought it was, you know, an Andy Kaufman bit. And Dick Shawn had actually died on stage during the performance. So it's one of those horrifying little moments where you're like, why do I know the name Dick Shawn? It's because he actually died on stage and people didn't believe that it wasn't part of the joke.
So there's something else going on in 1963 that...
Doctor Who?
No. Oh. That was also kind of... Well, yeah, Doctor Who was going on. So what's going on? You know, in 1963, more people are buying television sets than ever before. People are staying home. Homes are starting to get some central air or some kind of air conditioning at home, and people are not going to the movies. So during the late 50s, early 60s, we started to see a rise in what's called epic films.
Right.
Right. What's an epic film, Rodrigo?
Ben-Hur.
Ben-Hur is an epic film. Cleopatra. Cleopatra is an epic film.
The Ten Commandments.
Ten Commandments is an epic film. The Mad World is an epic film.
Yeah.
What makes a film epic?
Can I guess just from that list of
Go
movies?
Ahead.
They're really long.
Yes.
Boredom.
But more
than I'm pretty sure the Ten Commandments takes 24 hours of TV time to play.
It's about
it plays over the entirety of Passover. That's how long it is.
But yeah, you're right. But why? Why would they have to be so long? That's kind of a clue.
Big stories.
We have to tell big stories.
Big stories.
We
big
have
cast.
To make a big production. Mm-hmm. We have to have a big cast so that we can draw you away from your small set and see your favorite stars on the big screen in the case of Mad World.
Yeah.
Or to tell an epic story like Charlton Heston making out with Liz Taylor or Charlton Heston condemning people for praying to a golden
for,
ox.
For making out with or, whatever the name you just let.
Richard Burton making out with Liz
Richard
Taylor.
Burton making out with Liz Taylor, too. Who didn't make out with Liz Taylor in the 60s?
No, who did not?
Cleopatra. He did.
I didn't.
That was 1950.
But I mean, this is in that period where we have to make movies spectacles.
It's
how the West was won. All these things.
It's really a polarization because when they start going into TV, they say, "What is TV good at?" And it is that kind of like that mm-hmm. close up mm-hmm. sitcom type situation. And so then, what is film good at? It's like these huge sweeping things. That's what you can get the budget for in a film.
Right.
That's what a wider aspect ratio affords you.
That's mm-hmm. what I'm getting to. Mm-hmm. Is part of the appeal is prior to the 1950s. Films were still shot at a 4:3 ratio. That's right. Why television, it was so easy to make everything a 4:3, because if we're going to take these old films mm-hmm. and put them on television, it's the perfect aspect ratio. Well, now we need to be something bigger than television. So let us change the aspect ratio of our screen. And so then we started experimenting, or the industry started experimenting, with all of these different ratios and all of these different film formats mm-hmm. to make the movie bigger and better. And one film format that they used was CinemaScope, probably the widest film format that we had. And if I'm remembering correctly, I'm pretty sure it's the CinemaScope. They'd actually, maybe it was Panavision.
This one wasn't Panavision.
Okay, so Panavision. Yeah. So Panavision was this scope that was so wide that they actually would use three cameras to shoot the movie.
Continue.
Go ahead, what were you going to say?
Isn't that Cinerama?
And Cinerama. Yeah, maybe that's the one I'm thinking of. But they would have to use three cameras to shoot simultaneously. And then project them back simultaneously.
Right.
The biggest hang up was things not being in sync.
Right.
And so then we had to invent things like the Panavision and wide. Ultimately, what it led to was the introduction of anamorphic shooting, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. where you could compress the image that was super, super wide and put it onto one piece of film. And then when you project it back through an anamorphic lens, it would spread it back out and you could get that big wide thing. I mean, theaters at this time were experimenting with such wide aspect ratios that the screen would curve and kind of wrap around you. And I think this was one of those that was projected in a theater that would kind of wrap around you.
Yeah, I mean, it's super wide.
And, you know, when you watch it today, you see these four shots of characters in this movie, mm-hmm. and it's like, half the characters are cut off on the edge. It's because as they've converted it, they can't get that wide. Right, they can't get that original wide format. So when you rent this, it's only available for rent on iTunes now. But you're missing out on those characters because you can't fit them into the current aspect ratio. It's so wide.
Well, that makes sense now. Because that you talk about that, I remember that there's big conversation scenes where like half a person's body is on screen. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yep. No, and imagine if you could stretch that out twice as wide. And so, what I'm going to do is in the show notes for this episode, and I want you to watch this too, Zach, there's this fantastic video up on Vimeo, maybe you've already seen it, that talks about the history of the aspect ratio and how we've gone through all of these different changes and how we're essentially at our 1.85:1 for what we consider widescreen mm-hmm. and our 2.85 for the CinemaScope version. I'm going to put it up. It's about a 15-minute video to watch. It's put out by, I think it's filmiq.com, I think is the group that put it out. Fantastic video. You really, really should watch to understand how did we change all of these different aspect ratios over time. And Mad, 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 Mad World fell right in the middle of this time period where we're trying to do anything to get people into the screen, into the theaters by changing that aspect ratio. So definitely check that out.
I mean, the version I saw not only had an intermission,
right,
but it also had an opening, basically overture,
right,
that mm-hmm. just plays over black.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's like the movie itself is meant to be a theatrical experience.
Right. The overture is what would be playing when you enter the action.
Right. Right. I mean, like this, is what's played like while the curtains are closed.
Yeah.
In a theater.
Right. Yeah. Cinerama was the 3-strip process. Right.
It seems weird.
Like 1979.
Well, not really weird, just interesting that when film really started, we did films kind of like Duck Soup, where we shot it at like a theater because what people were used to, and then we kind of diverge a little bit through that in a little way, and then we get back to this age where we try to make it the film a theater to get people to come back instead of watching TV. Right. Yeah. It's weird.
Don't we do that? Don't we kind of still do that today? Don't we go and say, see it in 3D because you can't see 3D at home? Don't we want to say, see it in IMAX because you can't experience IMAX at home?
Right.
I mean, that's that's why these two formats are holding out, because it's it's that last hook to say, hey, person sitting at home watching your 56-inch television, yes, you could come down and sit in the multiplex and watch the movie on a 56-inch screen, or you can come see it in IMAX, or you can come see it in 3D, something you can't get at home. That's the experience you're going for.
Right. I have a 27-inch screen.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the way that IMAX does their like super wide format is they actually flip the film.
And that's what 70 millimeter was originally. You had to shoot it sideways to get it to go across in that. And in this case, the Ultra Panavision 70 is done that way, where actually, instead of the film running vertically, they actually run it horizontally, and that's how the IMAX stuff works as well. So it's a 70 millimeter. I think it's 70 millimeter.
70 millimeter, yeah.
Here's what I think is really interesting, sort of from a meta textual sense about this movie, is that it came out the same year, I believe, as The Great Escape. And you watch the two of them and they're just like nothing alike.
Right.
Not like Mad World is such a dynamic movie, and The Great Escape is like such a still movie.
Yeah. But I think part of that is, in The Great Escape, you have a lot of big names. But you're not presenting this in a big epic story that you're telling with Mad Max.
It's really a small story.
It is a small story.
It's a very small story.
And
intentionally so, I think.
Oh, and it has to be. It has to be.
Yeah, it's guys in prison. You want it to be as claustrophobic as you can get away with. Whereas again, I think that movie is kind of the shape of things to come in films. That 70s aspect of, we have the stories that are about the specific character and their quieter story, or the story that specifically everything we see happens because Jake Giddies is in the room and there is no omniscient expectation of, here's what the villains are up to elsewhere. We don't get that. I think that this, you know, like I said, this is kind of that throwback, that last hurrah, whereas The Great Escape is kind of trying to move forward into that 70s.
If we're tying this back into this last hurrah for the actors, it's also this grasping at straw mentality by the studios going, how are we going to compete with changes? And so I think three things that you should take away from this discussion, Zach, is epic storytelling, you know, what the epic movie period was and what, you know, how that affected the types of stories that were going on. Things like parallel storytelling and the aspect ratio, I think, are the big three things that you can kind of focus on from this movie, as well as Kramer trying to move out of an area that most people thought he was in and show people he could do comedy. I mean, that is always good to break out of what your normal role is.
It's just like Kevin Smith
doing Red State.
Schindler's List.
Are all good examples of actor or director saying, hey, I can take this on. So
Phantom Menace 1. How to Make a Bad Movie?
It's like, I know you all think I only make amazing action movies, but
let me put the lie to that.
So again,
he made Howard the Duck before he did that.
Oh, good point. That movie blows.
Also not on this list. So. All right, Zach. So beyond hating this film,
yes,
what are some important? And I've told you the three takeaway things that you should be looking for.
Right.
But what did you personally learn from? Oh, you had. Before we get to that, you had another question about quadcopter.
Oh yeah, so right before I watched this, I read an article in HD Video Pro, a magazine or something, and they're talking about how aerial shots are changing now, and they're becoming how smaller indie productions can do them now because the quadcopters and their the expensiveness of getting a helicopter and attaching all the gear you need to get a shot over the city, a car.
In this movie, there's a lot of chase scenes that have to be done from the air.
That's why I thought about it.
Now, real quick, a quadcopter being a little remote control helicopter with a
four propellers with a camera
attached to it.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Sorry. And a lot of people are doing this. They're not. Some of them to carry like a Red Epic.
There are bigger ones that are
pretty big, and they're pretty. I mean, from my mind, still pretty expensive, but to rent, they're not as expensive as renting a helicopter for a couple of hours to shoot the city.
Now, keep in mind when you're looking at quadcopters, you've got limited range.
Right.
You've got limited weight on these cameras. Yes, right. You can get some that hold the Red or hold a 5D Mark III. But for the most part, you're looking at small, like GoPro cameras or those types of cameras. So, yeah, I've got a quadcopter that I bought because I've really been wanting to do some more nature stock footage videos because people are interested in buying some of the stuff that I've already shot.
Totally.
And so I want to expand on that and do that with some aerial stuff. So the first one that I bought was that Parrot drone, the iPad controlled or the iPhone controlled one. That one is a piece of crap.
Yeah.
Doesn't do anything that you need. This one is designed specifically to hold a GoPro camera, the one that I got, the DJI Phantom. And it flies really, really good. Now, there's some stabilization issues that I've got to tweak and fix, but I've been taking some pictures with it, and I think you've seen some up on my Facebook page. I know I put a YouTube video up. Did you watch it? Did I show you the video?
I didn't get a chance to see it.
But it is really cool and produces some amazing results, so much so that I went to campus and was shooting the ground where the new building is being built and posted that, and people are like, oh, this is great. You should take some shots around campus. Well, our provost didn't realize I had one of those. And I guess he read some article about some other college had bought a quadcopter. And he's like, Senate fired off a note at the provost council meeting saying, hey, should we invest in one of these? Who should be buying it? Blah, 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 blah. And then my dean was like, well, you know, Steven's got one of those. And I guess the university relations has already been on me asking, hey, can you come and shoot, you know, pick and
can we borrow
and
your quadcopter?
Well, they don't want to borrow it. They just want me to go out and shoot the stuff. Yeah. And it's like, fine. And, you know, I do need some new propellers. You guys could pay me to go and do this. And be more than happy to do it. So, you know, the cool thing is you can do some amazing things. And if you go online, you can see some of the stuff that people are doing with these little quadcopters.
And
there's a company out of Steamboat Springs in Colorado that does this. And if you go on Vimeo and just look up Steamboat Springs, I'm sure you're going to find his stuff. But he uses an octocopter that's got eight propellers on it. It's GPS controlled and everything.
Yeah.
But he does some amazing, amazing videos of just flying over buildings and everything.
I mean, because now that cameras are so small, you have like the Blackmagic Cinema that is like a consumer level size, but you can shoot 4K on that. And so that's the weight of that is so small. You can send it up on a copter and you can get 2K, 4K images out of it.
Well, I've been saying we need to talk about gear at some point because that's part of this.
Yeah.
Why don't we next week talk about, you want to talk about gear next
week? We'll do a gear show.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, we'll do a gear show next week where we can talk about some of these things.
Yeah.
Because really the cost of entry for doing this stuff has lowered so dramatically that even young Zach can go and make a movie for and buy his own equipment for less than $10,000.
Easily.
Yeah. And just as a point of reference, you said easily. 15 years ago, $10,000 would have gotten you bare basics to do stuff.
Film stock.
And 20 years ago, $10,000 wouldn't have gotten you...
Nothing.
You know, a lens.
Yeah.
So we can talk about that next time.
Okay, let's do that.
Zach on film. So give me some good takeaways, some things that you can use from this movie, from It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, in an upcoming production of yours. Maybe a spot that you're supposed to do for us.
Yes.
He said, hinting broadly.
Hinting broadly.
I never hint broadly.
He hints very accurately with a hammer at your face. I mean, I think one thing you look at from this movie. If probably can't take this away from doing like your first movie in your house, but if you start making a name for yourself in Hollywood and you can get all these actors, then the odds of making a movie like this are good from a business standpoint, because obviously this is a lot of business. It made it a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's good. And that you can do that from just throwing an actor in there. You can probably up your box office by a couple million, but just by having Tom Cruise in your movie, like you just made like $10 million more dollars.
Right.
So for business aspect, I think that's one thing you could probably take away. Learning types of comedy is the takeaway.
Well, comedy
and trying to appreciate them. And then,
yeah, I mean, comedy is very subjective. So what you think is funny, other people are not going to think is funny.
Right.
And so that's why that's one area that I would caution you on is if you're going to do a comedy.
Oh, I would never make this comedy.
No, I'm not saying make this comedy, but if you're going to make a comedy, you're going to make sure that you understand who your target audience is, because more than likely you're going to offend 90% of the 90% of the audience from that. So because it's very subjective.
Yeah. So there's a good takeaway.
Did you just say you're automatically going to offend 90% of the audience?
You probably, I mean, you're going to offend a lot of people. I mean, Kevin Smith is a prime example of this when you look at who are you going to offend. Kevin Smith understands who his audience is, and he plays to his audience.
Mm-hmm.
His audience is several hundred thousand million people, maybe a million more people, right?
It's just me.
And he is playing to you. He's not playing to my mom, who doesn't think who thinks Kevin Smith is not funny at all, mm-hmm. and will probably burn in hell for his antics.
Right,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Just
totally
like will. I think, still base humor like dick and fart jokes still gets a laugh out of me. Right,
totally
right?
Funny.
Other people,
totally funny.
Other people, not funny. Some people hate the Stooges. Some people love the Stooges. Some people don't get. Monty Python. Other people love Monty Python.
People
some
hate people, Will Ferrell.
Some people hate Will Ferrell. Some people hate what's his name? Waterboy.
Adam Sandler.
Right? Okay.
All of those guys.
He's kind of taking a dive.
Name a guy that
honest.
Came out. Name a guy that got famous out of Saturday Night Live.
Gosh.
Somebody hates them.
Right.
True.
Because their comedy is very unique for their audience.
Changes.
Right.
Nobody hates Belushi.
That's
it's,
true.
It's like
no one
okay,
does.
So. Another good example is. I don't know if
wait,
you've
which
ever...
Belushi?
John.
I don't know if you've ever been brought into our Smosh discussions, how I don't find Smosh funny at all.
Yeah.
I think it's stupid, yet they
have a quadrillion,
people watching.
Right.
So there's people that think that their stuff is funny, but it is
what's
very subjective.
It's
you don't want to know.
Just go look it up.
Yeah, just go look up at smosh.com. Yeah.
I don't want to. The last time you looked at, you're like, oh, look up this goat say thing. And I'm like, I don't even know what that. I didn't leave the house for a month.
See, humor is very subjective to people. I got a laugh out of sending you to a site.
You're a horrible, horrible human being.
So just really keep that in mind is that, you know, even Bill Cosby, a lot of people don't find funny. They find him quaint. They don't find him funny.
Right.
Quaint. Right.
Puddin' Pops.
Well, that's quite quaint.
Yeah,
so just be real careful when you try to do something that you think is funny, because other people might look at it and go, you're stupid.
So pretty much my everyday life.
Well, again, it depends on who you're trying to target.
I get that a lot.
Yeah.
It depends.
I get a lot of blank stares
from
my jokes at work.
Well, that's because you're playing to the wrong audience.
Yeah.
Well, even if you play to the wrong audience.
You know, if you'd play in Poughkeepsie. If you play in Sheboygan,
if
you play in Walla Walla, Washington,
Peoria,
man. Peoria.
That's where we are. We're in freaking Peoria.
My humor actually plays at work, and I spend my day locked in a bunker with four or five grandmas, and my humor will occasionally still play. So, I mean, choose your audience, but be aware that your audience may surprise you.
Sure.
You know, if I can say what I say and get 62-year-old women to giggle, obviously, there's that chance that maybe your audience is, you know,
or maybe they're just
different.
Trying to humor you.
Yeah.
Do they give you some hard candy and pat you
like
on the head?
Butterscotch thing.
They give you a little pinch on the cheek.
Oh, Matthew, you're so cute.
Matthew, I'm going to knit you a sweater for Christmas.
Would you like a Werther's?
Occasionally, I do have to throw in a reference to Ernest T. Bass.
All right. Grades for Zach? Evaluation of Zach?
This one was rough because from a base, like, guttural perspective, I really agree with Zach.
Oh, no,
I did not like this movie.
Yeah.
And I think that, for me, watching this movie, I had trouble analyzing it, because after a while I was like, bah! So
I almost
turned
this movie off like three times.
You know, to be honest,
I'm gonna abstain from grading Zach this time, because this movie got to me.
Yeah, no, when you go and try to do searches for critical analysis of this film,
you
can't find anything on it. For me, it was you come into this realization of what he's trying to get at, because you're like, okay, look at the henpecked husband. Look at how these two buddies get along with one another.
Yeah.
Look at how people are greedy with one another. Look at how husbands and wife relationships are.
Right, right.
I mean, when you see all of
everyone's
that put
jerks.
Together, yeah, then you come to this realization of what makes this a comedy of errors, or comedies of
sure.
reflection of on ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think that takes a lot, because I've been watching this movie since the late 70s.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's how long it is.
Well, yeah. I just finished
still been running
last night. But no, literally, I've been watching this from the late 70s, and it wasn't until Ethel Merman is yelling at Milton Berle about how worthless he is, and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. This suddenly makes sense as to what's going on. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's a repeat viewing thing. I don't know. But so I will agree with you, Zach. And, you know, you're not wrong in your opinion of you didn't like this movie. You're not wrong in your opinion that this is too long, because I would agree with you that this is too long of a movie. And I wish there were parts that could move mm-hmm. along a little faster. So I guess we'll say we'll give you a pass this week
cool.
on this one.
Cool.
Matthew?
I think that sometimes I'm a little too hard on Zach because of the fact that I'll say, how can you not know Buddy Hackett? And he'll be like, Buddy Hackett was dead 12 years before
he was.
And that's true.
I mean, I don't.
And that's legit. Yeah. But I don't want to be the guy who's like, well, everything was better when I was a kid. And I'll agree with you. This movie drags. This movie drags like the muffler of my 77 Monte Carlo. And trust me there, if you look around, hey, Zach, you'll probably see discolorations and jagged spots in the road because they, you know, they haven't fixed them since the 90s. Where my muffler actually just gashed up Vine Street. And I think that for me, half the fun of this movie is playing, hey, it's that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen this maybe half a dozen times. I still can't necessarily give you a detailed analysis of the plot because I'm just like, Rochester! Hey, that's Rochester. And look, it's Alan Brady. So B+. Because you get the basics of the construction. You get the basics of what works. Doesn't necessarily work for you, but most importantly,
you watched
it. You didn't presume that because you didn't like it, it sucked and was awful, and everybody who would like it is stupid, and I'll give you points for that.
Yay.
So just to give our listeners a heads up and Zach a heads up and anybody else who wants a heads up on this next week, we'll talk heads equipment, up. Right? Mm-hmm. Then following that, it looks like we've got Blade Runner.
Oh, man.
And we're going to look at the 30th anniversary version of this.
Is it on iTunes?
The version that
iTunes.
I don't have.
Okay. Right.
Jerk.
Inception.
Oh, God.
Iron Giant.
Ooh.
Lawrence of Arabia. Let me give you a hint, Zach. This is another epic movie, right? Planet of the Apes, the 68 version,
mm-hmm.
and then Raging Bull. Those are the movies that we have upcoming.
Cool, it's a good list
on the Zach on film. And how many of these have you seen? Iron Giant, Inception, That's it. I'm gonna bet. All right. Okay.
There we go. That's going to wrap this episode up for Zach on Film. Make sure to head over to majorspoilers.com. Click on that amazon.com link at the front of the page and do all of your happy shopping. Buy any of those movies, Blade Runner, Iron Giant, Inception, and get a little head of the homework for Zach on Film. Watch his movies before we talk about them. No extra price.
You need to enunciate when you say things like that.
Nah. No extra charge to you, but a little bit will come back to us to help all these great shows that many of them, not including Zach on Film, there's so many more Major Spoilers podcasts to listen to. Keep those running. Go to majorspoilers.com to click on the podcast link. Give your thoughts about the mad world and any other thoughts you have about this show. That's it. Next week, we will be talking gear and the make movies and such. Next week on Zach on Film.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.